You know, I do teach about forgiveness, but it's a much simpler quality than that. That this whole, for me, the whole area. It's some combination of relax, get over yourself, relax. You're gonna die, so relax. No, I'm really serious. It's we make this stuff so difficult. You know, we make like normal human things seem so complicated and so esoteric and convoluted. And you know, if you look just in any way mildly objectively at life, you'll see that people hurt each other and that you hurt other people. So what are you going to do about that? I mean, some of the extra stuff we put around all this is what makes it such an interesting thing for me. Like all the drama that we lay over the simple reality that most of us are unimaginably selfishly absorbed. Because of that, we hurt other people and magnify the things done to us way out of proportion. So that's it. You know, like we're so narcissistically absorbed that we think that the world begins and ends with us, that the rest of the world literally barely matters, and that, you know, some of us can keep grudges going for 50 years. No, it's a very, right before I got in here, I'm flying to New York after this, just teaching at Omega, and I teach with, this stuff is remarkable, not my piece of it, but I teach with a surgeon who is showing people that you don't really need spinal surgery except in the most extreme conditions, and that he has, I don't know how many patients, 100 or 200 patients that he has helped in part with forgiveness. That, you know, you don't have to have all this rage and stuff, but he just sent me an email from a psychologist who was saying to him, and he passed it on to me because he didn't know the answer. He said, okay, I get it. You're supposed to forgive the past. This is what the psychologist was saying. But I have all these adult patients whose parents are still irritating the hell out of them. And first of all, how do you take that even seriously? Like you're an adult. If you don't want your parent to irritate you, don't communicate with them. Just do whatever you want. You're 45 years old. But so he says to me, my patients are always saying, I can get over the past, which I don't believe. I don't believe at all, because if you can get over the past, then you know how to get over stuff so you can deal with the present. But at least they like to convince themselves that they're more noble than they actually are. I can get over the past, but it's the present stuff where they haven't changed and they're still like violating my boundaries and blah, 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 and they're still the same rotten human being they've been since I've been six. That's not the sign of somebody who's gotten over the past. Right? At all. But so the therapist was asking, what do I say to them? And I said, well, the only thing I wrote back, because I get this question too often, I said, well, tell your clients that they're asking the wrong question, or the wrong couple of questions. Like one, like why am I still expecting old people to be different than they are? Like, haven't I learned anything? And two, why haven't I not in my adult life learned to take responsibility for how I feel? Like, it's nothing to do with your parents anymore. Like, you know, like asking the wrong questions. And I was thinking, like, why isn't that a more common question? Like, what are we all doing blaming everybody? And I understand some of it. But I don't understand all of it. I don't understand fully the human tendency to not want to own our own bad behavior. Like that I don't fully understand. That somebody who's upset with their mother for 40 years, irregardless of what their mother did, has a problem. Their mother, it doesn't matter what the mother did. If you stay upset with somebody for 40 years, you haven't checked life out at all. Like you've been living in a bunker, you know, with no information coming in, barely air. And what are you doing? Like 40 years later, still thinking your childhood matters? Like, are you kidding me? Like right now, there's like, I don't know, I don't remember what the exact number is, but you know these horrible stories that like 35,000 children starve to death every day under the age of like 8. And you're still worried about what happened when you were 8? Go feed somebody. Go do something useful. But the very fact that you're still thinking of your childhood now as if it matters is shocking to me. Not shocking, because we all do that, but just, like, are you kidding? Like, that's a relevant question? And so that's what I mean by people are in a bunker. Like, it's an airtight way of having the world not really exist outside of your own head. Because there's suffering everywhere you look. So why are we so obsessed with ours? Especially old stuff. I mean, new stuff, yeah, it makes sense. But old stuff? Like, I know people who are still mad at dead people. See, that's the one that gives me, like, real humor. Like, you're mad at dead people. Sometimes a lot of dead people. Like, I can't believe they did that. But they're dead. But this is our mind. This is the mind that we are saddled with. A mind that makes enormous difficulty for us and causes us so much pain because we don't see life clearly at all. Like we don't check it out. And the things that I have seen, again, you know, I've been running the Stanford Forgiveness Project now for almost 20 years. And I've met a good number of people who have experienced real horror that I don't even have words for, you know, it's like, I don't know how anybody copes with some of this stuff. But 95% of the stuff I've seen is just everyday stuff. You know, my husband lied to me, my kids lied to me, I lied to me. You know, they don't love me anymore, I don't love them anymore, they were mean, nasty, unconscious, insensitive, just everyday stuff. And if you look around, it's happening everywhere, all over the place. So what is that quality that has us obsess about the everyday stuff that happened to us and regurgitate it endlessly, awash in a world of real current suffering? Like, how do we defend that to ourselves? You know, how do we defend the capacity of our mind to literally hold on to memories of things that happened to us in this short life where we could actually be useful, you know, to help? So there's this enormous disconnect of attention and empathy, you know, that's normative. It's, you know, and having worked in some really awful situations, so we've done a small amount of work in the Catholic and Protestant thing in Northern Ireland, and we've done some work post, like, Civil War in Sierra Leone, and, like, places where it's, like, unimaginably horrific. And part of that is because human beings hold on to their own stuff. sometimes for generations and generations and generations. Like, your side killed my great-grandfather's, like, third cousin. Your side did that. So I'm not letting go of that family hatred or tribal hatred to your side. So we have the capacity, we don't recognize how cruel that is to hold on to it. What an act of violence that is, that we're seeding the world with violence, of hatred and contempt and all this other stuff by holding on. It's like what is unseen is how much it takes two to make a problem. You know, you, one person to give offense, but you fully require the other to take offense. And if the other person is healed enough and there's no offense taken, then you don't have the same problem. But we're not taught that it takes two to have a problem of the offender and the offendee who's so identified with the role of offendee. You know, hi, I'm Fred. I had a lousy mother. You know what I mean? It's like, what does that mean? But it gives me a way, when I say, hi, I'm Fred, I had a lousy mother, it gives me a way to then pay the world back for not loving me enough. It gives me an excuse, it gives me a mental schema, and it gives me a way to defend my own insensitivity. Well, of course I'm not nice to you. I wasn't loved as a kid. Well, we all do this. Every one of us does this in our intimate relationships. Well, what are you expecting of me, to be an adult? What, are you crazy? We all do this. Don't expect me to be an adult. But the pain of, like, not releasing the identity of victimhood, it doesn't mean you forget what happened, but there's a very specific kind of identity that I'm a victim. I've been harmed by something, like, outside of me. And therefore, I don't have to be fully responsible for how I live my adult life. Which is very, it's a very delicate thing. I remember, and there was some very interesting experience I had as these ideas were forming in me. I remember once I was doing a couples therapy session, maybe 20 years ago. And I remember, like, couple A, person A, not couple A, but, like, I have no idea what gender this person was, but I'll make, they were female. And the husband said something obnoxious to the woman. And I remember the woman turning to him with contempt and said, how dare you talk to me like that? You know that's the way my father used to talk to me, and I told you never do that. And she was angry. And I'm sitting there as the therapist thinking, wait, there's something so wrong with this picture, so wrong. I couldn't articulate what was so wrong with it. And it took me a little while to realize that what's so wrong with it is that she needed to be apologizing to him. I'm sorry. I'm triggered by my past. It's not you. It's me. You're not my father. In fact, my father's not even my father anymore. I'm 35 years old. It's all me. And I'm really sorry that I brought my crap to this marriage. And I remember thinking, I'm in a very strange field that doesn't make that abundantly clear. Like, wait a second, honey. How old are you? And who's sitting in front of you? And whatever you tell yourself, that's fine. But this is not your dad. He never was your dad. And your dad isn't the same person anymore. So accept that you're damaged and own it and apologize for it. And then make haste to try to heal yourself. But I'm watching this and I'm thinking, wow, this is so bizarre. Like, I never got any education in, like, anything around this kind of, well, wait a second. This woman is, the only thing I'm seeing is her unkindness. He didn't try to hurt her. But she has attack. because her role as a victim was so identified in her. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with her reacting with pain, because that's what's triggered and that's what her imprinting is. That I get. It's the schema and the language that she uses in herself that gives her permission to be harsh to him. We all do that to some degree. We're all, like, guilty of that. I'm not whole. And anything that reminds me of how I'm not whole needs to be stopped and criticized. So, but that's what my profession has taught us in some degree, psychology. You know, be very, very careful with, and I don't even like the word victim. I mean, I happen, you know, to subscribe to some sense that the world is a reasonably orderly place and things happen as they should. But I don't know that. You know, I can't know that. But the idea that some things that have happened to us in life are not as they're supposed to be, or are somehow out of tune because they're painful to us, that I don't believe. Because if you look at life, it's regularly painful. You know, simply, you know, what I've said to so many people, even if you have the most perfect life, this I've said it in classes, one day you'll just wake up dead. You know what I mean? Like, you don't get away. Like, even if everything goes right, every single person you ever loved will die. So, like, don't be so, like, angry at the things that remind you of your vulnerability, even of your helplessness. Because that's what we're all fighting against when we don't want to forgive. We're scared to death of recognizing how absolutely vulnerable we are at all moments. That this skin is permeable, this heart will stop beating, that we can't protect those we love, and at any moment, anything can happen. And so pain and unpleasantness and unkindness reminds us of how vulnerable we are. And I believe it's that that we are resisting at all costs. That there is no way to fully armor up and protect ourselves. And so what we do is we get mad or blame or get pissy at the things that remind us of our vulnerability. Like, what's so terrible? I mean, look, I'm not advocating for unkindness or cruelty. But what is so terrible about remembering that that happened to you? It can be a sign of so many things besides and including the damage it does to our neurobiology as we are growing up. Parental cruelty is not good for the brain. There's no advocacy of that. But at any moment you can remember, yes, I have been harmed. Well, that puts me in good company, say 7 billion people. Right? That kind of gives me entree into a very select group. And let me look at the paper this morning or watch the news and see how many people just today are being grievously harmed in this world. Just to touch us. That's an alternative to victimhood. Do we use some of these things that happen to us to open our heart or to close it? I mean, that's the question. You know, do we open our heart? And one of the ways we open our hearts is by accepting our vulnerability, by accepting at a very deep level how lucky we are that more bad stuff doesn't happen. And with that vulnerability, to be capable of touching the part of us that shares that with everybody. We're all vulnerable. We're all watching someone die, or, you know, like, this is the mix. And so to be so angry and self-absorbed, to unforgive one, to not forgive one teeny piece of this, just one teensy slice of what life is, I think misses the mark. I mean, it's not terrible, it just misses the mark. Because it's based on a kind of faulty foundation. The other simple thing that I saw and we saw is unforgiveness rests usually on a platform of a lack of gratitude. That's been probably the strongest association that I've seen. That someone who objectively looks at their life in terms of what they have gotten that they haven't deserved versus what they have gotten bad that they haven't deserved, the what they've gotten good so outweighs what they've gotten bad that it's not even close, like food every day. I mean, what did any of us do to be fed when we, you know, or to have a sunshine us or anything? But we so highlight the things that we don't think we deserved in the negative way and basically ignore all the things that we can't quite deserve in the positive way. You know, strongest among that, the human mind appears to be wired to struggle for gratitude and positiveness. It appears to be wired that way. It appears to be wired in a way that we are threat-centric. That just appears to be the way it is, that our brains are oriented so exquisitely to what's a threat to us, and very, very, very roughly to what's good. Which is how, you know, when people are asked, so what do you like about your marriage partner? I'll say, he's a nice guy. What don't you like? And they come out with War and Peace. One of the things that I have come to see when I think about unforgiveness in its relationship to gratitude, and from what I understand, from my little bit I've been reading now in terms of what makes a successful couple, gratitude may top the list. I mean, it's hard to know, like, the ranking of it. But there has been some recent research on the incredible importance of just being thankful for what your partner does. Just flat out thankful. But I think of it in terms of, because I know how many people that I've talked to who ask, how could they do that cruelty? How could they do that unkindness? Weren't they thinking? What the hell were they thinking? What's wrong with them? So this question of where does this unkindness come from? And more importantly, because they don't really care where it comes from, they just want to know why it came to them. Like, they couldn't care less if it came someplace else. Like, go slaughter 50 people in Syria. I don't care. Just don't do anything to me. I mean, that's our basic take on the day. Don't do anything to me, but I'll read the paper and see that 300 people were bombed here and 180, you know, were an avalanche and 300 fell off a train and 200,000 starved to death. That's all fine. Just give me my coffee on time. I mean, that's our attitude. Don't be late. You know, don't make me wait in line at the supermarket because I'm important. But what do I care that, you know, thousands of people starve to death? So there's a basic problem with our consciousness of how it is that we orient ourselves, which predisposes us to a lack of forgiveness. The gratitude piece is the simplest entree into changing that. So one of the ways that, like, you know, I have thought about this is anybody who's in a committed partnership, like, you want to think about, like, all the ways you're loved that you couldn't possibly have caused. Like, it's like humility training, which is at the heart of forgiveness. Like, if I think of the one quality that is most in alignment with forgiveness, it's humility. I'm not the center of anything. I'm not that great. I didn't contribute that much to the world. Why wouldn't it harm me every now and then? It harms everybody else. But the peace in a relationship is, like, I don't know how to put this. Nobody has to do your laundry. Nobody has to go to work. Nobody has to feed your child. Nobody has to love you. You're not that important. You're not that valuable. It's a wonderful thing that people do this, but we don't see it at all. The narcissism is so dense that we don't even see what people do. I mean, mea culpa. I think it was 15 years being married before I noticed that she didn't have to do the laundry. I'm just, you know, really? It's not just done by the laundry fairy? I thought that's who came in and did it. But what I'm getting at is the basic consciousness that we're all struggling against. It's a very basic thing we're struggling against, to get over ourselves. You know, one of the studies that I read about couples, which was really interesting, and I don't know the exact particulars of it. They did some couple thing, which is very common, is you stick a couple in a room and you ask them to have an argument. I mean, I know that sounds weird, because most couples will do it without having to be stuck in a room. You know, they don't need any prompting to have an argument. But what they would do is they would film and evaluate how the couple fought. I mean, Gottman did this work to develop most of his couple knowledge. I don't know that this was his, but I remember seeing the study. And what was so fascinating was they were trying to relate couples in trouble to how much good they saw in the partner. So during the argument, if in any actual couple, there will be repair moments. So like partner A can be saying to partner B, I don't like you, you do this, this, and this. But a healthier couple, when they say this and they notice the reaction in the couple that they've been hurt, they stop for a second and say, you okay? You know, are we getting too intense? Or let me put my hand on your knee and just show you we're still in this together. Or I'm sorry, or they'll crack a joke. You know, look at me, I'm all tense. I'm like Attila the Hun here, and it's just my wife. But they'll do something to repair at some point. The interesting thing was these repair things are happening all the time in decent couples, all the time. Like they're attuned to each other, and it's not that they're afraid of saying I don't like you, what you did is wrong, I don't want this, but they don't lose sight of the fact that, you know, he's a human being. But what was fascinating was when they had a confederate or an observer watching this, and then they asked the couples, what did your partner do to, like, be nice to you? Like, list all the, you know, all the things. The distressed couples were the ones that didn't see it clearly. The happy couples, they saw it accurately. That goes against so much of the BS we tell ourselves about life, that you have to be realistic and you have to be hard and, you know, the world isn't da-da-da-da. Well, it turned out that the couples that saw it accurately, I noticed when he reached out to me. I noticed when he said this. I noticed when he took a breath. I noticed when he turned away or said, you know, my wife's a good soul. I noticed all that. The happier couples were the ones that saw the good. The unhappy couples were unhappy because they didn't see the good. They were too wrapped up in their own negativity. Okay. There was another, and this experiment I don't know exactly, but because it's fuzzy in my brain, but it was relating gratitude to couple satisfaction. And if you had gratitude for what they did, well, duh, you were better off in the relationship. It doesn't mean that your partner is better than the partner that's not grateful. It just means you have something. And it turns out that because we're, you know, we have very, very, very simple, most of us, minds, when somebody says, thank you for doing that, it reinforces you're doing it, right? Like if they say, oh, how nice of you to clean up, that's going to get more of a response than you schmuck. Why didn't you clean up? I mean, this is all duh. All duh. But so the gratitude piece is what I sense, gratitude and humility and compassion, or what I sense lacking in our world that doesn't forgive well. A person who cultivates gratitude sees enough of the good in their life to be able to hold some of the bad. Like, wait, I know. You know, I know that I've been given X, Y, and Z, and I have all these benefits and opportunities. Well, I can, you know, okay, so this crap happens. It's like, it's okay. It's not good, but it's okay. Those who don't practice gratitude tend, my belief is, to have a little more free-floating hostility. You know, that, wait a second, the world's not giving me what I need. Nobody's nourishing me. So when somebody really doesn't nourish, they wanna really hurt. And it's very easy to cultivate gratitude. It's very easy. I mean, it's like Oprah wants you to do it. You know what I mean? It doesn't get easier and more like simple than that if she's promoting it. No, I'm serious. It's like then it's like universal stuff. And it's a very simple thing. It's like asking yourself at some level, like, what kindness was sent my way that I didn't fully see? You know, what kindness was offered me that I was too busy for, too preoccupied for, or that whatever it is, I've taken it for granted? That's where our minds need to be occupied to balance out the almost obsessive way that we examine all the things that weren't the way we wanted. Like what I've seen is you don't need to go into the wounds so much as place the wounds in context. So if you thought, wow, okay, so this person really mistreated me, but these six have been really nice to me. Well, why would I be, why aren't I like jumping all over myself to say thank you to the six? Why am I obsessed with the one that's not? What's that say about me? Right? So this is a way of using the mind but not fighting or resisting unkindness. You can't resist it, it's everywhere. But it means that you don't have to dwell in the wound. And that's what our forgiveness project understood, that I believe has enabled our project to have more reach than any other forgiveness work that I've seen. That it's saying that, you know, shit will happen. Expect it. Prepare for it. I mean, you can't fully prepare for it, but prepare for it. But hold that within a container of the world's also rich and loving and nourishing. And I'm not the center of the universe. And people suffer everywhere. So what's the strategy for dealing with the world as it actually is? That's the container that we set to hold forgiveness. You know, and we've done this with, you know, some pretty horrendous things and some pretty, like, nothing things. Like, I've talked to people whose neighbors put their fence 2 inches on their property, and they're apoplectic. They've come into my classes acting like somebody shot up their whole family. What are you kidding me? What were they thinking? The property line ends here and their fence is here. And I don't know what the hell's wrong with them. And how could they do this? And on and on and on and on and on and on. You know, one of the things that was very interesting when we started doing our research, because I was really interested in, is are long ago things harder to forgive or current things? Are things from people close to you harder to forgive or things from people that you don't know? And what I found out was, generally speaking, the hardest thing to forgive is what happened to me. Short, long, well-known, unknown, it doesn't matter. And then I make up a whole theory about why it's harder to forgive what happened to me. So I remember being in a class, and I asked the class, it was, you know, maybe not quite this big, but, you know, number of people. I asked the class, so tell me which is harder to forgive, somebody you cared for who betrays you or somebody you don't know at all? So depending on what the hurt was, that's how they responded. So somebody would say, well, I can never forgive my brother because we grew up together. And, you know, how could they do that after all we went through as children? Okay, fine. Then somebody else would say, but wait a second, it's very easy to forgive your brother because you have nice times, you know, like you have balance. It's like, of course, you know, my brother's going to do this because 4,700 other times or whatever it is, he was nice and he's not nice and it's my brother. Other people would say, well, it's really easy to forgive somebody that you don't know because they don't mean anything to you. And then somebody else would say, well, it's impossible to forgive somebody I don't know. At least if I know them, I have some way of explaining it to myself. But how do I explain indiscriminate cruelty? You know, I did some work with people whose family members were killed in the attacks on 9/11. I did some work in New York around that. And I remember that was part of the brutal horror for some of those people, that it just felt like bad luck. You know, why would my son? You know, they don't know him. You know, he was just working in that building, or he was walking across the street, or he was in the subway station and got up to get a newspaper. But how could I ever forgive somebody whose hatred was so indiscriminate that they didn't care that it was my son? They would have killed anybody. But that's what's so unforgivable, that, you know, of course, maybe I could forgive something if I understood the genesis, you know, my son had done something, or they saw my son as something, but they don't know my son from anybody. How do you forgive that? Like, it's just, it's so unimaginable. So the thing is, what I have come to see is forgiveness is mostly a question in our mind of what we believe the world to be, how we believe people should act, and what it is that we think is fair for us. It has much less to do with the actual event. Now, the caveat to that is, many things that happen to us require grieving. And so it's not like forgiveness happens like 15 minutes after somebody does something really hurtful to you. There's a period of suffering that is essential called grief. You know, where you feel all those emotions, all the terror and the horror and the vulnerability and the rage and all the outgrowths of hope, of helplessness. And those can take months to heal. Forgiveness is, in my estimation, like the natural end of the grieving process. That you grieve and the wounds are raw and real, and then you let them go. But that's what forgiveness is. It's not a substitute for grief, and it doesn't interdict pain totally. It can't. Because we human beings, first of all, are strongly attached, you know, biologically to other human beings. And certain wounds rip apart the schemas that we have about life. They just rip them apart. And to restabilize can take time, even a lot of time. You know, when a child is murdered, we have this schema of this young person is going to outlive me, is going to carry on my experience. I'm the one who's going to go first. And then when something happens to that, not only is there the loss of the human being, but there's the loss of the understanding about how life is supposed to be, and it's a massive accommodation to bring the reality in line with the way we held it, which is what most of forgiveness is. When people don't want to forgive their parents, what they're actually saying is, it's too challenging for me to change my understanding of life. It's too hard, and I don't want to do the work. I want to believe that parents are supposed to be kind and caring and supportive and generous and loving. And I had a parent that didn't meet that standard for me, whether it's true or not. And I'm unwilling to do the work to integrate reality, which is not all parents do that. My parent may not have, and maybe my expectation was out of line. But to work to integrate that reality, to be able to come up with a more true reality, which is many, many parents fail to provide a safe home for their children. Many parents. And many children, as a result, have to struggle to gain emotional maturity and competence. That's a gray, nuanced, it doesn't, you know, it accepts that it would be wonderful if everybody were raised well, but they're not. Now what do we do? But that takes a flexible mind, and it takes an ability to hold pain and not have to have an enemy with the pain. That there's a cognitive accommodation to reality. And I see how hard that is for so many people. You know, I only have a few minutes left. This all started for me when I was very badly hurt. Like, the reason that, not the reason I started teaching forgiveness, but the genesis for this experience and my willingness, for whatever reason, to go into my own flaws and weaknesses, which were pretty extensive. My very close friend betrayed me. This was a long time ago. And betrayed me in a way that I had no, there was no map at all that this was even possible. Like, I thought this was my closest buddy and that we were going to be close buddies, you know, forever, or whatever forever meant. And so not only did the wound hurt dramatically, but I had no mental place for this. You know, like many people have that with their marriage. There's no place for the fact that my wife or husband may be a cheater, or may be the one to leave, or may be abusive, or whatever it is. There's no cognitive space in there. I had no cognitive space for the fact that this person may betray me. And when that happened, I was devastated, both on the emotional level, but more in the, this world is not a safe world at all, because there's nothing I can depend on. None of my conceptions of how life should be were true. And so it completely destabilized me, which is, I see what happens to people all over the world when events happen that they don't have a place to hold them. You know, they have all this almost fantasy of the way life is. And then reality intrudes. Well, for the good or for bad, it took me years to recover from this, years. And I did, and this is the reason that, you know, I'm a reasonably effective forgiveness teacher. It's almost like the alcoholic who can go back in counsel and see all the bullshit that the people who are still drinking give, because they've been there. Well, I saw my own BS. Like, it was, you know, I saw myself, just to give you an example, I would be talking to somebody, and somebody would ask me about this person. And I would start out like I was a reasonable human being for about two sentences. And then I'd attack the heck out of them. But I had this little veneer of, like, I'm a reasonable person, you know, I'm not psychopathic. And then about 4 seconds later, like, foam's coming out of my mouth. And somehow I made that his fault. Like, you, I mean, I had such an interesting system that I could behave terribly, and that was his fault. And even years after that, if I brought him up, it was his fault. Like, what makes me 2 years later need to bring that up? But any time I had an opportunity to make him appear like a bad guy, I took it. Gleefully. I alternated between depressed and angry. I created a whole victim persona for myself, which was partly true. This is what I'm getting at. If he could do this to me, then I'm not safe. And that's true. It's what do I do in a world where I'm not safe, where the armoring of my heart and the anger, that's not a good answer. But the question is a right one. Since he could do this to me, anything can happen. That's true. That's flat out true. Where I went off the rails is, well, because of that, I'm going to be bitter and mistrustful and take every opportunity to tell the world that I don't agree with how it treated me. That was my solution to a truth that I didn't want to hold. But everybody who's hurt struggles with that. Everybody. If my husband could lie like this, there is no total security and stability. That's true. That's just true. But the answer is not in becoming hostile. And that's the experiment that human beings have been doing since human beings have come on the planet. When we recognize that it's not safe, which is always, to protect ourselves, we become more selfish. And I don't believe that that's the solution that is best oriented for us, both as individuals and as a group. Forgiveness allows us to say that, yes, this hurt was awful, was inappropriate, was wrong, was anything, but I'm not going to allow that to change my character for the worse. That's what it does. Like, it doesn't deny the harm. You know, I was on the radio a few times and interviewed just recently about the shootings in Charleston and how quickly some of those family members forgave. And I had been interviewed a decade ago when the Amish murders, where nickel mines were occurred. And you know, it's a very tricky thing because there are some religious people who have so practiced forgiveness and so practiced an understanding that when something happens, that's what they have to offer, that it's true for them, you know, that, but for other people, the forgiveness serves as an attempt to not feel the horror of it and to not feel with compassion how often people are harmed. Like, that's not an appropriate use. I mean, it's better than going out and killing somebody, but it's not the deepest use of forgiveness. the deepest use of forgiveness is that we live in a very difficult, challenging world of great harm and injustice. And that while we can forgive the individual perpetrators of it, because we have to, it doesn't absolve us of the responsibility to continue to try to have our hearts open to make the world a better place. You know, to that being harmed, many of us use that to step away from a kind of trust in the world. You know, that I can't trust anymore. That, you know, and you see that all the time in relationships. You know, somebody was in a 20-year marriage where they find out that the hubby has been having a long affair. And they, I'm not trusting anymore. Now, the truth is it can take a while to trust again. But the deeper understanding is even from the beginning of any relationship, it's guaranteed to end. That's the, you understand what I'm saying? So it's like front-loading the wisdom a little. It's teaching this. So when you enter into a relationship, you know that that relationship is going to end. And it ends either by death or by mistreatment or neglect or indifference, but it's going to end. And so if we looked a little more carefully at what this world is, and we developed a better schema for what it was and how it was that we're going to respond to it, then we would handle more skillfully the stuff that happens. So, and I'm going to stop in a minute. What I have developed, and I'll do a little bit of it in an hour, is some methods for doing this, and they asked me to do a workshop kind of thing for an hour or so too. Just some very simple methods for helping people become like a little more grateful, a little quieter inside, have a little more humility, and just, you know, to realize, again, this is the bottom line realization, that unfortunately, I have to work on my nervous system. Like, no matter what happened, in the present, I got to work on my responses. And there are very reasonably simple, proven ways for doing that. I mean, meditation and prayer and exercise and affirmation and goodwill and all these stuff. But all these things practiced, they work on our nervous system. And so, you know, not with complete assurance, but with some assurance, we can take people from all sorts of, like, difficult things and orient them to saying, okay, yes, this painful thing happened, but at some level, what you need to work on is your mind and nervous system now, so that you release to some degree the past's hold on you, and you're more, you know, you're just more in present life. And, you know, as all sorts of converging evidence shows, that's good for people, you know, to be more in present life. Anyway, thank you.